it's Tony Gonzalez with the latest rock news. An unexplained fire destroyed the Aberdeen Museum of History over the weekend. Within the museum was an entire section dedicated to Aberdeen native Kurt Cobain and the iconic career of Nirvana. Flames 15 to 20 feet high consumed the building as black smoke filled the interior, destroying the artwork and historic memorabilia inside.
It has been more than 3 years since that fire destroyed the Aberdeen Armory and the History Museum inside, and now some Aberdonians are getting frustrated by delays in replacing it. Our resident historian Felix Bunnell is going to try to sort things out. Felix is brought to us by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Good morning.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, this is a complicated story, a lot of misunderstandings and hurt feelings, along with some small-town politics. Before we get to that, though, I want to talk about the museum that was lost in the June 9th, 2018 fire. The 1922 Aberdeen Armory building was owned by the city, and the museum was run by a mostly volunteer group that founded it back in the late 1970s. Along with the Kurt Cobain stuff, there was all kinds of artifacts and photos, old fire engines and stained glass windows. The setting itself in the old gymnasium of the building had nice high ceilings. Much was destroyed, but a lot was salvaged, too, thanks to a massive recovery effort in the wake of the fire. Nancy Kyle is treasurer of the Friends of the Aberdeen History Museum. Her mom was one of the founders. They're part of the social fabric of the community. She says the museum was more than just a room full of stuff.
It was just a little bit of everything, and it was just a remarkable building. And many people, after it burned and they saw the pictures of it, said, oh, my, we didn't make it the museum. We always meant. But now we see what we missed.
Now, I mentioned the misunderstandings. A lot of those have accumulated in the past 3 years. And I'd say it's only partly because of the pandemic. One issue has been a lack of a suitable replacement building. The old armory was so badly damaged it had to be demolished. Nancy Kyle of the Friends told me the Aberdeen City Council and Mayor Pete Shave have tried to help, but there's been friction.
I believe that the intent of most of the city council members, they're not against a museum. They just didn't know that the city had a moral obligation to provide for that. They just thought it would come from somebody else. And many of them thought that somebody else was the Friends of the Aberdeen Museum. And so I think that's one thing. The mayor has tried to help us in several ways, but the last statement that he made to a group was that this museum was not a priority for him right now. And everybody jumped on that. And so that became a very negative and divisive thing.
So you heard her say that she believes the city is morally obligated to rebuild the museum. I think moral obligations can be hard to enforce. And when Mayor Pete Shave said in July that the museum wasn't a priority, well, Nancy thinks he was misunderstood.
But I'm not sure that he meant at all that he was not interested in a museum. It's just that right now they have the levee, they have the gateway, the fire department wants a new fire station, the police department wants a new police station, and the city's in financial trouble. So it's just like one more thing that he just couldn't handle all at the same time.
So, I mean, the History Museum is an emotional topic for many people in Aberdeen, and there are a lot of other things going on that the insurance money from the fire is helping support. The city of Aberdeen got $23 million about a year ago for loss of the armory and its contents. That included the museum and two other organizations, a senior center and a social service nonprofit called Coastal Community Action Program. Now, Nancy mentioned some of the big projects the city has on its plate, building a flood control levee, building a tourism and economic development project called the Gateway Center. The city has so far spent about $14 million of the fire insurance money on those two projects. Now, exactly how much of the $23 million is left over for possible use for a new museum is not really quite clear. This is Aberdeen Mayor Pete Shave.
So there was a total of about $3.5 million that went to the museum fund. And then it paid expenses. And I think at this point they have about $1 million left.
Yeah, and the expenses are a storage facility where the artifacts are currently stored that the Friends don't have access to. And what the mayor says differs from what Nancy Kyle says she was told.
The city was also running in the red a little bit. And I believe they took another chunk of money to make this year's budget whole. In the end, out of the $23 million, the city treasurer has told us there's something less than $4 million left. That's uncommitted.
So there is some money left, but how much isn't clear? And what is left isn't necessarily earmarked or restricted to use for the museum. Now, along with the mayor and the city council and the Friends of the Aberdeen Museum, there's one more party involved, a museum board appointed by the mayor. Now, the board wants to take advantage of the fire as an opportunity to bring the museum up a few notches. This would be with more staff and with professional accreditation from the American Alliance of Museums. They don't want to displace Nancy, Kyle, and the other friends, but they do want something different than what the city had before the fire, something professional and sustainable. Now, this group is not without its own friction with Mayor Shave. For instance, in my conversation with the mayor, he expressed disappointment that the City Museum Board had not done any fundraising, specifically taking advantage of federal COVID relief dollars.
That's a frustrating thing with the city-appointed museum board. They have not done anything to reach out for any of those dollars. And I told them that before, and they've never done that. So it's just frustrating.
Now, John Shaw is chair of that city-appointed museum board. For his day job, he's executive director of the Westport South Beach Historical Society. That's the maritime museum at the mouth of Grace Harbor in Westport. I shared with John Shaw what the mayor said about the city museum board not raising money.
Oh, my God. Did you get him on record of that? Because he expressly disallowed us from doing any of those things. That's just absolute baloney. You know, the idea that the museum board should have been going out for outside grant funds related to anything, we have asked on a number of fronts to be able to go after things, and been precluded from doing anything that is any sort of grant request or outside activity.
Yeah, so there's a lot going on in Aberdeen. Yeah, and every to a person, I had long conversations with each of these people. Everybody is passionate and wants this museum to come back. There just seems to be lacking some ability for it all to be pulled together. The public meeting tomorrow night, there is a public meeting at 6 o'clock Thursday at the Aberdeen Theater. The Friends have organized it. Nancy Kyle told me they want to reach the public of with the message of what they're trying to do and kind of what they believe the various parties' obligations are and to get community feedback. So it's not exactly a reset or a reboot, but there still is great potential. But the thing is, the money seems to be kind of gradually draining away with these other projects, which everyone agrees are priorities. But balancing it all out, getting private money and finding a place for this museum and professional staff to do what everybody thinks needs to be done, boy, that's going to be tricky. But if, you know, I'm pulling for these guys, and let's hope they can pull it off, because it was a wonderful museum. I never visited there, but we'll have some photographs at My Northwest. And, you know, I love history museums. So let's hope things turn out for the best in Aberdeen.
Felix Burnell, crusading for history.
No, I just tell the stories, Dave.
Yeah, I know. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. I have two grandchildren who will grow up with smartphones in their hands. In fact, they've already got smartphones in their hands. And when they start talking more fluently, they're going to start demanding questions from Siri and probably Alexa. And Alexis Hinneker, a senior author and UW assistant professor at the Information School, wrote up a study on this, conducted a study on this. And, well, first of all, what were you trying to find out, Alexis?
So we created this little interaction pattern where anytime someone in conversation is speaking slowly, you can tell them to speed up by using this nonsense word that we made up, bungo. So I could start to speak like this, and you could jump in with bungo to tell me, you know, that's kind of annoying, and can you sort of speak at a natural pace again?
And what happened when you taught the kids how to do this?
You know, to start, I had no idea what we were going to see. I had no idea if any kid would use this. But first, what we saw was that they picked up on it right away. They were really good at working it into their conversation and just kind of accepting this as part of how you talk to this particular kind of digital interface that we had created. And that part wasn't too surprising. You know, lots of studies have shown that kids can learn new things from robots or other personified technologies. But then the researcher that had been running the experiment would leave the room and say, you know, I got to go get some supplies for the next set of activities. I'll be right back. And the parent who had brought the child to the experiment was sort of in on things and would have a conversation with the child. And then at some point during that conversation, they would start to speak slowly. And that was where I was really curious to see what would happen. We were not sure if any children would use this bizarre bungo term with their parent, but the majority of them did. They brought it straight into their conversation with their parent the first time that they encountered their parent's slowed speech.
How did they do it? Did they interrupt their parent and ask them to speak faster? Did they treat them like the AI?
So yeah, that was kind of the most reassuring and fun part of all of it. Most kids thought it was hilarious that their parent was sort of playing robot with them. And so they would start laughing, they would interrupt them right away, they'd start shouting bungo, 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 and sort of like, oh, I get this joke, and I want to play too.
What did it prove?
Well, there was sort of one next step, which is what really brought everything together for me. So after the child had chatted with their parent for a little bit, the researcher running the experiment came back and then interviewed the child to ask them, you know, what kinds of technology they like, if they'd ever used an Amazon Echo before, what they think of these kinds of systems, how they would create them if they could change things. And at some point during the interview, the researcher would also slow down the way they were speaking. And so the kids at that point would kind of give them a look or make eye contact with their parent. And you can kind of see on the video footage that they're kind of thinking like, what is wrong with this person? But they were so polite, you know, they didn't interrupt. They did not say bungo. They just let them kind of draw out this painfully slow interview question. And then they would respond kind of thoughtfully after the fact and just sort of put up with this painfully slow speech from the researcher.
Okay, so that's kind of encouraging because it shows that even if kids get used to being able to order around an AI software program, they know to differentiate between that and a real human being. In other words, it's not going to turn them into bratty, bossy children.
That was my takeaway for sure. I mean, we saw a lot of social differentiation in kids' behavior. They would talk to a second robot and they would use bungo really matter-of-factly. They would talk to their parent and they were totally down to playfully use bungo as a way to kind of bond with them. And then when they were with this stranger who was interviewing them, they decided bungo wasn't appropriate and they would just kind of default to typical conversational behaviors. And so the kids did this over and over again on the fly with no coaching at all. And they seem to really know how to differentiate between those different social contexts.
Do you think it's still important to teach kids to say please and thank you to their AIs, though? I kind of went that direction at first when we put Alexa in our house. Oops, I think I just turned mine on. But I always wanted to make sure that my kids said, you know, whatever they requested, please. But it sounds like that doesn't matter, that they'll learn manners no matter what.
Well, you know, I'm kind of torn. So answering more as a parent than as a researcher, yeah, I still want my kids to say please and thank you, no matter what the context is. But at the same time, I was kind of reassured to see that there appears to be some protective effects of these kind of pre-existing relationships that kids have and their understanding of what it means to interact with other people. So they're not going to kind of wholesale, simplistically transfer everything that they learn to do with a robot onto every person that they meet. And that gave me some hope.
I think please and thank you are for humans, not machines. If you say please and thank you to a machine, you're treating it as a human. And I think it's important to make sure that kids are aware when they're talking to a machine and when they're talking to a human. Alexis Hinniger teaches at the UW Information School. Alexis, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
And we haven't checked the COVID dashboard in Snohomish County for a while, so let's go up there right now. And Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott, who joins us live. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Yes. Well, and it's pretty much the same situation across the state. And things in Snohomish County, we've been hearing state level, various counties are seeing plateaus. And that's essentially what we're seeing right now in Snohomish County. Dr. Chris Spitters is the Snohomish County Health Officer, and he says right now there's good news and bad news.
The good news is that the rapid increase in cases that has brought us to this difficult point seems to have leveled off over the last couple of weeks. The bad news is that we've leveled off at an extremely high transmission level, as high as we've ever seen during the pandemic.
That rate, by the way, is about 470 cases per 100,000 people in the county. Again, the highest that they have ever seen. He says the situation if you're looking about, like if you're talking about being out in the community, here are some of the numbers.
In a crowd of 100 people in Snohomish County, there is a 75% chance that at least one contagious COVID case is present. For a group of 50, that risk is 50%. And even for a group of 10, that risk is 12%.
And hospitals continue to struggle.
106 Snohomish County hospital beds this morning are filled with COVID patients, 19 of whom are on ventilators. On the vaccination front, we continue to make only incremental small progress. 57% of the county's residents are fully vaccinated, but over the past month, only 5,000 to 6,000 people per week have initiated vaccination weekly. And if you, you know, do the math on that, it would take us almost a year to get all 200,000 folks done.
Obviously, that is not acceptable. So he's really, again, reminding everyone to get the vaccination and hoping that there's a different outcome there with those numbers as far as the number of people going to get vaccinated and starting that process. He also reminded everybody about the new outdoor mask mandate that took effect for crowds five or more outside on Monday and took it further.
I also will join local and state health officials in strongly encouraging people to wear masks outdoors in crowds of any size, whether it's an organized gathering or not, when social distancing could not be maintained and you're around people that you don't live with. Furthermore, I also recommend that everyone consider delaying or moving non-essential events and meetings to a future date or move them online to a virtual format. If it does not need to happen in person right now, I think it's in everyone's best interest to reschedule or hold things online.
Here's why.
Remembering that we're at the highest transmission rate we've ever seen with this pandemic, and that previously we would, we have the benefit of remaining open, but let's use that freedom wisely and judiciously for conducting our essential activities, education, employment, grocery shopping, going to get health care, things like that, and try to take it easy on some of the non-essential aspects of life that we all want to return to enjoying, but now is not the time.
And less than a week of kids being back to in-person learning in Snohomish County, there's COVID in schools.
As of yesterday, we had 74 school facilities in the county reporting one or more cases. There are five sites with two or more cases and no sites at this time with more than five cases. And the split on staff to students is roughly two student cases per one staff case. 12 of those, COVID events, if you'd call them, one or more cases, are associated with athletics.
So he said he was asked when he might shut down schools or what might trigger that. And he's leaning towards more of a kind of a targeted approach. Right. So at this point, there's no real guidance on that, though, from the state health department or the state school superintendent office. He says he knows they're working on it. But for him, it would more likely be an individual school or groups of kids, a class, something like that is the hope, and where you didn't have to shut down, obviously, countywide school. Here's something that was sobering when I heard it. I'm not sure what actual question he was asked, or he just kind of gave an assessment of what we're looking at in the future as far as COVID.
Even if COVID kind of transforms over the coming months and years into a seasonal respiratory illness like influenza and other coronaviruses that are more mild, it's not going to be mild like those. It would be more serious like it is now, hopefully just fewer people getting it. And so given that I don't think I'm too far out on a limb to say eliminating COVID, an unmitigated victory against COVID in the near future, is not on our menu. And so we're all going to have to live with it. And that's going to mitigate its effects and try to keep society going and have some new sense of normalcy. Vaccination has to be a key ingredient with that. So actually accommodating COVID is really going to require vaccination, or you know, whether it's this winter or next winter or the one after, if we have dual winter respiratory waves of medical surge, every year already influenza puts the hospitals on the brink before COVID. So now we'll have two of those.
With the flu, and they won't be able to take that. But you hear him talking about 3 years out, right? And it's not, you know, COVID will not be this simple, you know, like common cold that a lot of coronaviruses end up being. It will be a serious threat. And that was something I had not heard yet.
Yeah. I'm curious, though, because, and listeners have asked me about this, we keep talking about how many are in the hospital, but we never find out is how long they stay and how serious these cases are. Now, it's never, you know, when you have to be hospitalized for something like the flu, that's clearly serious. But if it's not a ventilator, then that implies you're going to recover and be fine, right?
Oh, for the most part, not always. I mean, I think you heard him say there they've got 19 people on ventilators in the hospital. I can tell you that my personal doctor is in a hospital in Snohomish County, and I had a virtual appointment with her a week ago, and she told me they had to do a makeshift ICU because they ran out of room. And it's not the first hospital I've heard have to do that. So it is a significant problem right now, and we've got the lag. Even if cases plateau, there's not going to be this big down, you know, drop in cases is not the expectation. It's going to maybe stay at this plateau or, God forbid, come back up again.
Well, then now are they going to have to think then? I mean, if this is the new normal, then the responsible thing is to expand ICUs. I mean, you're just going to have to put on more capacity, aren't you?
You are going to have to, and I think that's what you're seeing. Like I said, makeshift ICUs, but you'll have to build out. Here's the problem. The problem is still, though, that you don't have the staff. You don't have the staff. They don't have the staff anywhere in this state, even outside of the state, and the burnout is ongoing and continuing, and it's going to get worse. So they've got to get the vaccinations done, and they've got to try to get these numbers down, because at a certain, they're on the brink right now. Hospitals are on the brink. That's what he said.
Hannah Scott. Thanks, Hannah.
You bet.
It's time for the Daily Dose of Kindness now, sponsored by Robert W. Baird & Company. A woman is bringing makeovers, food, and love to Los Angeles's homeless community. Shirley Rains is her name. She gets up early and heads to Skid Row. That's the neighborhood in downtown Los Angeles known for its struggles with homelessness and poverty.
We come out as a team every Saturday and feed over 500 people, about 500 people. And then I come out on Tuesdays on my own and feed another couple hundred from my car. And then sometimes I come on either a Wednesday or Thursday.
At Skid Row, Rains wears many hats. She's a makeup artist, a hair technician, a provider, and sometimes even a mother figure.
The beauty services are very important. That's pretty much how we started. Of course, food and stuff is necessities, but beauty is more of a want sometimes versus a need. And they have a right to want to have their wants met.
Some professional barbers have teamed up with Rains to offer services, all thanks to social media. This man tells ABC News he's grateful.
We're hurting so bad, man, in the streets. And I really love these people, man, that they're treating me like a person. This is a blessing to my life, man, to have you guys over here and helping me out. I lost everything in the COVID, man.
Rains has begun documenting her work, too, and the stories of the people she serves on social media. It's earned her millions of views and likes on TikTok.
Social media sponsors all of this. I mean, without social media, we wouldn't be here. They're the ones that we get donations from. You know, if we are short on water, I'm having a hard time because there's no tents or sleeping bags or blankets. If I take to social media, all of a sudden, you know, they're sharing and sharing and sharing. And then we've got some people who have large platforms sharing. And all of a sudden, we have the things that we were missing.
And she reminds her followers to have compassion for people experiencing homelessness and to give back to those in need as much as possible.
The character that people place on the homeless. Like, I'm like, they look like and act like I used to act when I was going through a lot of stuff. This is the new Shirley, and I have to adapt to it.
Again, her name is Shirley Rains, if you'd like to look her up on TikTok.
Here is G. Scott. G,
yes,
how are you?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Good.
We talked with the University of Washington researcher, Colleen and I did, about how kids interact with smart devices, a very clever experiment where they had the kids try to speed up a robot voice and slow it down. And the conversation took a turn towards how polite should kids be to their devices. For example, when they're talking to Siri or talking to Alexa, should they say, Alexa, please tell me how to outsmart my mom? Or, you know, Siri, please tell me where they hid the cookies. Stuff like that.
yes, they should. And I believe that manners is a lost art these days, right? Where when probably the three of us were coming up, those things were really important. And I don't think they are as much now. When I was coming up, it was sir, yes, ma'am. It was Mr. and Mrs. It was please and thank you. That's a lost art today. And it's unfortunate that it is a lost art, because the truth of the matter is those manners carry on the rest of your life. And some of the main reasons why, I know education is important when it comes to jobs. Jobs experience is important when it comes to jobs. But to make it in the professional world, there has to be some form of manners. Please and thank you goes a long way. So back to this study that you guys are talking about right here. How are these kids going to communicate? We are communicating, especially during this pandemic, where we are seeing people less and less because of what we had to do with quarantine and being locked away, whatever the case might be. In this day, we are communicating with people less and less, and we're communicating through, you know, social media, on phones, and all of those things. So we're not communicating as much. So, yes, I do want the kids to have to say please and thank you. And parents, you should have your kids say please and thank you. And yes, please to the device.
Woo! Couple of thoughts there after that. One,
yes.
I'm the type two that wants my kids to say please and thank you to AI as well. However, what I'm trying to reverse is this idea that respect of authority, whether it's an adult or AI or whoever it is, doesn't need to be 100%. That, yes, you can say please and thank you, but also know that you can push back against an adult. Because I think what comes with always say please, always say thank you, is always be courteous, always be polite, be nice, to the detriment of the child, where they think, okay, this is an adult. I've been taught to say please and thank you. I've been taught to respect this person, but they're asking me to do something that makes me feel uncomfortable. So I need to push back. So as long as we're not teaching politeness without caveats, that you can listen to your intuition and decide if this is right or not, that's what I worry about, that we take this whole politeness thing too far and it gets kids in trouble.
Well, I'm curious, do you think your microwave, when it warms your tea?
Well, it doesn't have a voice, at least my microwave doesn't have
a
voice.
So having the voice is the thing. So if the microwave had a voice, was voice controlled, then you would thank it for warming
probably
your tea.
Hey, didn't you start to treat Jibo like a little pet?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was the whole idea.
But
notice it's gone now.
If my microwave, right, if I just placed it, my food into the microwave, and it said, hello, G, don't worry, I'm going to take care of this for you. Thank you. Appreciate you. And then I go do something else. Come on down, G. Your food is ready. It's hot, ready to go. Hey, I see you, microwave.
You'd say thank you.
But instead, I still, you guys are going to laugh at me. No matter what it is I'm putting in the microwave, I have been doing this since I was a kid. I've never shared what I'm going to tell you with anybody. I always press 333 start.
Why?
I don't know.
You just like that number. And do you stop it? Or do you let the whole 333 go?
Yeah. No. So I stop it, take it out. You see what I'm saying? Maybe stir it up a little bit, put it back, stop it. Boom. You know what I'm saying? Let it go. Okay, cool. It's good.
I don't. We might be related, because I don't press 333, but I press 123 because I can just run my fingers along the first row of numbers. Then I press start.
We family. Somebody listening right now does a specific set of numbers every single time, and then you just kind of you go there.
That's right.
I always stop it at 1 second. I don't ever let it go off.
Now that's weird.
That's
weird.
Yes,
why is that weird? I would rather just hear one beep rather than a series of beeps when my food is done.
Okay. All right. Fair. You know what? That's fair. Here's what's really weird to me. I don't know why this went off the scale. Here's what's really weird. Is anybody that just puts, let's just say you put a minute, you let it go beep, 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 and then you take it out. You're like, ooh, it needs to go back in. And then you set more time on it. Oh, that's weird to me.
G joins Ursula for their morning cooking show starting at noon here on Cairo Radio. Thanks, G.
How to cook like a neurodivergent.
Is that what that is?
That's what it is, Dave.
Let's go back now to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. King County has launched a new dashboard to highlight systemic issues in the sheriff's department. And there's a new WSU study offering a report card on bias in traffic stops that might surprise you. So to explain all this to us, here she is, Hannah Scott.
Hey, good morning, Dave. Yes, first we'll start with this dashboard that is just announced from the King County Auditor's Office. And again, it looks at some of the systemic issues that you find within the sheriff's department. Kimber Wasmussen is the King County Auditor, and she explains a little bit more about what this is.
We put together this website to give as many insights as possible to the public and to decision makers as there's this transition from an elected sheriff to an appointed sheriff.
Among the information,
over the last 10 years, we've done 11 audits and made 93 recommendations to both the sheriff and to kind of the sheriff in combination with other actors. So there's a lot of work that we've done. It's a little difficult to digest. So what the team did was pull everything together, look for themes, just to make it easy for decision makers to understand what areas might have systemic high risk within the sheriff's office as they're making decisions moving forward.
Brooke Leary is the law enforcement auditor for the county, and she worked on this.
So we regularly follow up on all of our recommendations, and the website contains detailed information on the status of the recommendations and links to all of our most recent follow-up reports. So there are some areas where many of the recommendations have been implemented, but what we are emphasizing in this website are where are some of the areas where we see the sheriff's office having greater difficulty in implementing recommendations? What are some of the issues that come up over and over again across audits? And what types of issues are most likely to create challenges for the sheriff's office in complying with local and state regulations, ensuring the safety of the community and its officers, and just being transparent to the public?
Some of the other things that this will cover include...
So we observe trends and themes.
And that's what we just said. So she'll talk about some of the...
talking about here? They're talking about use of force or
no, it's not use of force because they have not done, and those 11 audits that they've done, they've not done one yet on use of force, but I believe that they will be planning to do one. So they'll update this dashboard.
And is this a public thing or just for...
It's a public thing. It's a public thing. It's great. You can go and you can really take a deep dive into these audits. So when you do these audits, they're very lengthy and they're very kind of high level. So what the way they've put this together on the kingcounty.gov website, by the way, is that you can go and find these five categories that they have, which I'll have her explain here in a minute, that they've lumped everything into that they found in these 11 audits over the last decade. So their common themes that have come kind of risen to the top is problematic and systemic issues. But it's not your usual, it's not part of the conversation you always hear about, right? It's not going to be your excessive force because they haven't done an audit yet on that. But they do have sexual assault investigations, for instance. So is the sheriff's department doing the proper follow-up and engaging with the victims of a sexual assault? That kind of thing will be highlighted in there. And you can take a deep dive. There's a little thing that you can click on and go deeper. And then all the way into the audit, if you choose, and the video of the presentation to the county council that was done back whenever the audit was done, where they really discuss in great detail all of the findings. So there's, you can go very, very deep if you so choose. Here's a little bit more on the categories though.
What we see in this area is that audit recommendations involving collective bargaining really involve critical issues, and they are some of the most difficult and time consuming for the sheriff's office to implement because bargaining can take many years. Sometimes they will, attempt to bargain conditions to implement our recommendations, and they may not succeed, and they may go back to the table in future contracts to work to implementing the recs. And so what we see looking at recommendations we make that are bargained is that many of them still stand after 5 years. I think we have a graphic on the site showing that 36% of the recommendations we have made that the sheriff's office in the county are bargaining are more than 5 years old.
So that's the first of all.
So
the five.
I'm still not getting a feel for what these issues are. Is it workload or bias or what?
So collective No, not bias. So the five areas that they're talking about are administration and data quality. And what that has to do, it sounds very boring, but if they don't have, I know, if they don't have this data within the department, then, you know, they can't, the data is not provided to the auditors. So because the King County Sheriff's Department isn't keeping it, right? So that's a problem. They don't track things and they don't have some of this data. For instance, that was something that they came across in sexual assault cases. They didn't have certain data that the auditors felt that they needed. So that's a systemic issue. Another bullet point that they have here in these five areas is collective bargaining, the contract cities, staffing, and training. So training will include, will venture in likely to that excessive force area. Where are we, you know, are we seeing deputies react the way that we're training them to do? Especially, you know, we've had multiple lawsuits settled just in the last couple of years involving the sheriff's department. So that will all be things that are gotten into, but it can also be training on just, you know, your everyday basic stuff. It's just, again, the things that they found in these audits that they recommended changes for. You'll also be able to see, which is very cool, the 93 changes that the auditors have recommended over the last decade. You'll be able to see the progress on which of those the sheriff's department has implemented.
Okay, not all so, of them, obviously. Let's get to the State Patrol study that you also were looking into. And this is a report card on bias in traffic stops. What did they find?
They found, and this is, I think, going to be surprising to many, that over a four-year period, there was no evidence of systemic bias in decisions by state troopers to stop vehicles. But there were still some trends that of Hispanic, Native American, and Black drivers being searched at higher rates than white drivers were. And this is, again, the study out of the Washington State University. So that is something that we've seen, I think, across the board in the few of these that have been done in the state in other departments, where you see, I think Seattle Police just had one done not long ago, where those searches are happening more for people of color, drivers of color. But no, zero pulling over of people just because of bias is what this WSU study found.
Well, I guess that's good. Now, given that all this stuff is now public and we're having dashboards and stuff, so if somebody decides to dive into all this, all these audits, and they find something that they think is suspicious or they're angry about, is there a little feedback button where you can...
There is not a feedback button, but you can certainly find an email address and put that out there, or go to the King County Council. So why this is important, by the way, this King County dashboard, is at the end of the year, we will no longer have an elected sheriff, as we have for many, many decades. We will have an appointed sheriff. That is something that the voters approved in the last election. They also approved switching basically control of the sheriff's department away from the sheriff's department and giving the major decision-making authority to the county council when it comes to what duties the sheriff's department will have and how they're going to operate. So you can go to the county council, right, is the answer to your question. Okay. That will be something that you will be, you'll be like, okay, this is an issue that I see and I want to raise, or and you can have your complaint and make it to the county council. They will also be doing future audits, again, as on the excessive force and on bias in stopping for traffic violations. That is one of the next things that they have coming up that will eventually be on this dashboard as well.
All right. Our radio's Hannah Scott. Hannah, thank you.
You bet.
Q, Rachel Bell. How would you like to have your own private nature show airing live in your yard every day? There are a few key steps you can take and become certified, as we hear from Cairo Radio's Rachel Bell.
So we have lots of lilacs. These coneflowers are very attractive to pollinators.
Lisa Ryan lives on a quiet residential corner in Edmonds, but attached to the chain link fence in front of her yard is an official metal sign that says Certified Wildlife Habitat.
The broken pot there is shelter for any small animal that comes to drink.
It's a program run by the National Wildlife Federation.
I just looked it up online and found out what the requirements were and that I really already met them. So they sent me a sign.
There are five requirements to turn your yard, apartment, balcony, garden, schoolyard, work landscape, or roadside green space into a certified wildlife habitat.
You have to provide food for wildlife, and we have lots of fruit trees and bushes and native berries. This is a bee balm. The insects and birds love it. It's probably the most popular plant in the yard.
There needs to be a water source.
So I have a fountain with fresh bubbling water on the patio, and I provided a couple of terracotta saucers that go under plants, and I keep the water clean in those and put rocks in them so that anybody who falls in can climb back out. And I would see the crows bathing in there and the insects coming to drink.
You must provide shelter.
Right over here in this flower bed is a place where a bunny had a nest.
There needs to be a place to raise young.
We have little birdhouses everywhere, but they mostly like to pick their own spots. And we have some dead trees. And we've seen, I think it's the nuthatches, that will actually excavate into the dead wood and build a nest in there. And it was so much fun to sit out and watch them raise their babies, feed them, and teach them to fly. Fifth thing is sustainable practices. So we don't use anything toxic. No pesticides, no fertilizers that are not organic.
There's a $20 application fee that goes towards supporting the National Wildlife Federation's programs, and no one comes out to certify your yard. It's all based on the honor system. But their website provides a guide for selecting plants that will create a healthy habitat.
Ticked off, I already have this one, and then I went and got some that I didn't have. And I try to get a lot of native plants. That way the native pollinators have something to come to.
You don't have to have a big space, and your yard doesn't have to look like a jungle. There are simple ways to attract bees, bugs, and critters.
We've had a big change in the number and the type of insects that are showing up. More types of birds we've seen in the last few years. Lots of bunnies and squirrels. Way too many squirrels. And I like to share. I don't mind sharing, and they're welcome to all the apples they want, but I didn't get a lot of fruit this year because I guess I was too liberal in allowing them to help themselves.
Creating a wildlife habitat in your yard goes against the natural instincts of most people to keep the bugs off the plants, to compost piles of leaves, and to shoo away birds and critters eating your fruit.
I have read that if something's eating your plants, that's a sign that your garden's healthy, so I just live with it. I do wish I had enough fruit to make jam this year, but oh, well.
For more information on certifying your space, go to mynorthwest.com/Rachel Bell.
I've always liked wildlife. I've always liked wild places, and I wanted to have my yard be kind of a refuge. Mm-hmm. I have lots of place to sit and just watch what nature's doing and be able to just sit and share the space with them is nice.
That is Rachel Bell reporting. What a delightful, it sounds so delightful to be a certified habitat, Sully. I kind of want to do this.
My habitat is a certified bad, according to the Homeowners Association.
Don't you have a lot of blackberry bushes to take care of?
Trust me. It's been the vine roses that kind of come in and take over. And they grow everywhere and have choked out so many of our trees here. So I went kind of crazy on them over the summer and chopped them all down.
Because you could also hire goats if you wanted to.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I've got two lazy cats. Why can't they do it?
Yeah, and a very fit son who, when he comes home for Christmas break, could probably help you out too, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, when I got COVID, he was coming home for the whole month of May, and he couldn't do it. I was going to use his muscle in a big way. That didn't happen. So, well, sorry, yeah, my lawn is not a habitat for anything but moles.
That's okay. I'm going to start working on it. Thanks for that report, Rachel.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at mynorthwest.com.